Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today. We're expecting sunny skies to remain the rule, and we'll top out somewhere in the mid-80s or so. Should be a little bit warmer under mostly sunny skies tomorrow. Currently with relative humidity at 18%, it's sunny and 81 degrees. In a quick check of traffic, watch out for an accident. It's on the 101 westbound at 7th Street, and it's blocking the HOV lane.
The funeral for Phoenix police officer David Glasser was this morning in Peoria. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from our West Valley Bureau, the crowd that overflowed into the courtyard outside the church shared laughs and tears.
A handful of people spoke during the service. Jason Poole was Glasser's best friend. He said he asked Glasser to be best man at his wedding because Glasser was, quote, the best man I ever met. Glasser and Poole started families at about the same time, and their firstborn children, a boy and a girl, were separated by only 6 weeks. Poole says it wasn't long before Glasser started joking that their kids would get married one day.
And I always said that if Micah turned out like Dave, that I was okay with it.
Poole says that since Glasser's death, he has rewatched the video of his wedding so he could see and hear his best friend. Glasser was fatally shot last week while responding to a burglary call in Levine. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Peoria.
An Associated Press investigation has found hundreds of breaches at the nation's airports over the past dozen years. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, many of them occurred at Sky Harbor, with some having gone unreported.
In all, the AP found 21 intrusions at Phoenix's main airport since 2004, many involving fence jumpers. The more high-profile cases in recent years include a woman with her infant son in the vehicle crashing through Sky Harbor's perimeter gate and a homeless man who scaled the barbed wire fence, ran onto the tarmac, and began banging on the engine of a plane. Dr. Richard Bloom is director of Terrorism Intelligence and Security Studies at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott. He says Phoenix figures are not out of whack with the rest of the country, but disturbing nonetheless.
People who intend to attack aviation, maybe through terrorism, for example, view these as free experiments. They engage in their own surveillance and reconnaissance, and they check out how security personnel address and respond to and try to resolve each of these.
None of the 345 breaches AP documented nationwide involved a known terrorist plot, but there's a discrepancy in what the AP found out and what Sky Harbor officials reported. Phoenix police in charge of patrolling the airport documented only 12 incidents in that time, say they have no record of the other 9 breaches found by the news organization. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Arizona could stand to bring in an extra $113 million a year if voters approve an initiative to legalize marijuana and tax it at 15%. That's among the findings of a new report from the Tax Foundation, which looked at how much tax revenue Colorado and Washington State have brought in from pot sales and applied that to other states based on their populations. Joe Henchman is vice president for state projects at the Tax Foundation. And Joe, how much do you think money and revenue projections should factor into the decision whether or not to legalize marijuana?
Well, we obviously think it should be part of the discussion. And marijuana touches on so many different aspects. It hits everything in public policy. There are people who believe what they believe for moral reasons. There are people who believe what they believe for criminal justice reasons. There's people who believe what they believe for health reasons. And there's people who believe what they believe for revenue reasons. And I'm a tax lawyer, not a marijuana advocate, not exactly anyone. I don't think I know anything special about morality or about health law or healthcare or anything like that. But what I do know are tax numbers, and we wanted to make sure that people had those numbers that are out there. And the revenue you can expect from legalizing marijuana, it's not enough to repeal all of your other taxes, but it is considerable.
Where do you think it falls as far as some of the potential costs that having more people potentially using marijuana might incur on the state?
Yeah, that was an important question we wanted to try to find out. And so in Colorado and Washington, we had a lot of interviews with officials at the state and local level. We often heard this from the local officials, because while the revenue, most of the revenue usually goes to the state, it's the local officials that have to deal with the any crime issues or any zoning and licensing issues or any health issues. And the consensus seems to be that there are additional costs, but the revenue is exceeding those costs.
As you said, you're not necessarily an advocate for legal marijuana. You're a tax attorney. Do you think that given your research on this, I mean, does that persuade you one way or the other as to what is the right course of action?
Our main purpose in the paper was that if you are going to legalize marijuana, here are things you need to consider in doing it, and here are some of the benefits and costs associated with it. That said, I presented on some of these findings to a room full of state legislators, and there's about 200 legislators in the room. I think all 50 states were represented, and I asked them two questions. First, I asked, how many of you, understanding what you know about the benefits and costs of marijuana, how many of you support legalizing marijuana in your state? And it was maybe half the room raised their hand, the other half did not. Then I asked the second question of, all right, now I know not all of your states have ballot initiatives, but say your state did have a ballot initiative to legalize marijuana, would it pass? And there might have been one or two people who didn't raise their hands, but almost everybody raised their hands.
Based on your research, did you find that there's sort of a sweet spot for how much marijuana should be taxed? I know you provide numbers for a 15, 20, and 25%. Did you get the sense that one of those provides the right incentive so that people use it, so the state can generate tax revenue, but is not so high that it scares some people off?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the trade-off that you have on marijuana taxation is it needs to be high enough to raise the revenue, both to cover added costs and to provide benefits from undertaking the policy, and also has to be low enough to deter people from just going to the black market and or continuing to buy in the black market. For instance, Colorado, one of Colorado's objectives in legalizing marijuana was to wipe out the black market. They started at about a 30% tax rate. Washington State was an over 30% tax rate. And in both states, the black market, while it's taken a dent, continues to exist. So actually, both Colorado and Washington State are acting to lower their tax rates in an attempt to continue to wipe out the black market. Other proposals that are out there range between 15 and 25%, which is why we use those numbers in our analysis. And I think that we're going to see tax rates start to come down, probably not as low as sales tax rates, which are like 6, 7, 8%. But I don't think we're going to see many much higher than 25% anymore.
Joe Henchman is vice president for state projects at the Tax Foundation, which has put out an analysis of how much tax revenue states could bring in from legalized marijuana. Arizona voters may be deciding this fall whether or not to do that. A campaign to put the issue on the ballot has said it's almost collected enough signatures to qualify. Seth Liebson is chairman of Arizonans for Responsible Drug Policy, which opposes legalized marijuana. And Seth, what do you think about this study from the Tax Foundation?
Yeah, like every study on marijuana and revenue I have seen, it only gives half the picture, and I think it's a terrible way to do public policy. It's still all based on guesswork. By half the picture, I mean it never tells us the costs. It never tells us the other side of the ledger. It doesn't tell us what the costs will be for treatment, rehabilitation, counseling, increased traffic and workplace accidents, enforcement, criminal violations, dropout suspensions, and true education deficits. We need to know those numbers to make an informed decision, and we're never told what they are. The other side, the pro-legalization side, says they want to regulate marijuana like alcohol. We can use alcohol as an example on this very point. We do take in revenue from alcohol. We take in about $80 million in revenue in Arizona. We spend about $2.5 billion in costs.
What about the argument, though, that people in Arizona are already using marijuana illegally, and by legalizing it, at least the state gets something out of it if it's already paying some of the costs of some of the medical problems and workplace problems of people who are using it? At least the state should get something for that.
But it is not a net gain. It is not a net gain when you make more available a dangerous, addictive substance, high-potency substance. It's not a net gain when more people use it. Let's look to the example of Colorado. Since they legalized, just youth use, just youth, ages 12 to 17, has increased 20%. They're getting it through legalized means now, and Colorado youth use rates are 74% higher than the national average. Arizona can do that. That will be a choice for the people in Arizona in November. But whatever is taken in will be far outspent by what will have to go out. Keep in mind, if Arizonans legalize marijuana in November, they're not getting rid of all the other needs at Department of Health Services. They're not going to get rid of all the other needs for education and all the other needs that people go to the governor and the state for to get treatment money, to get addiction money, to get counseling money. All that is still there. They're just going to be taxed further.
Seth Liebson is chairman of Arizonans for Responsible Drug Policy. We'll post a link to the Tax Foundation analysis at theshow.kjzz.org. Governor Doug Ducey and Secretary of State Michelle Reagan are officially canvassing the results of this month's special election today, in which voters narrowly approved Proposition 123. That'll settle an ongoing lawsuit in which a judge found the state had illegally withheld money from schools meant to cover inflation costs. But the state could be facing a new lawsuit over education funding, this time over money for building construction and maintenance. Tim Hogan is the executive director of the Arizona Center for Law in the Public Interest. He's been talking to school districts about this issue, which has been an issue for many years.
We had filed litigation back in the early 1990s challenging the school finance system as unconstitutional because it failed to provide school districts with any funds for capital, including renovations, repairs, new schools, things like that. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of Arizona declared the system unconstitutional, and the state put in place legislation called Students First in 1998, which provided capital funding, dedicated capital funding for school districts to use. And that worked for a while, but eventually the state started cutting back on the funding for that and ultimately repealed it. As a result, school districts are starting to have facilities that are deteriorating, that they don't have the funds to repair or otherwise maintain.
How widespread is this problem? Is it a lot of districts statewide? Is it maybe just some in a particular part of the state?
Well, it's part of what the original problem was. Because the state provides no funding for capital today, school districts that have the wherewithal and the an adequate tax base and voters who are willing to approve the issuance of bonds can get bonds issued that address their capital problems. Property poor school districts who have a small tax base or a constituency in the school district who don't want to approve the issuance of bonds are just up against the wall. They have no place to turn. And as a result, those facilities just keep deteriorating.
Do you think that the passage of Proposition 123 could potentially complicate this issue?
Well, I'm sure the state would want to say it complicates this issue. But remember, Proposition 123 is to restore inflation funding. And so it's not new funding in any meaningful sense of the term. It is inflation to be able to keep up with the expenses that school districts had. And so that money, from what I've seen, most of that money is going into teachers' salaries because teachers haven't had raises, they've had layoffs. And so if you remember that it represents inflation funding, then I think that's the answer to the question. No, it's not going to have an impact on the capital problems.
So is your ultimate goal here to get more money back into the school facilities board? Do you want a totally new process for this? What would you like to see?
Well, the process that we've got right now is this school facilities board, which is appropriated annually a very small amount of money. So, you know, the school facilities board doesn't have the capacity or funding to be able to address this problem. So you need a systemic change of some kind, either revert to Students First and fully fund it, which the legislature was never willing to do completely, or come up with a new system for financing capital within school districts.
That's Tim Hogan, the executive director of the Arizona Center for Law in the Public Interest. He says he has to update the data from districts on their building and maintenance needs and that he does not have a timeline for filing a potential lawsuit. Daniel Scarpinato, a spokesman for Governor Doug Ducey, says the governor would prefer to avoid a lawsuit and points out schools will be getting some more money for these needs.
In the budget that was passed for the next fiscal year, we doubled the amount of dollars that go to school capital projects. So schools will have additional dollars for resources for building and maintenance. This is something they had asked for, and we feel like it's a good investment.
Scarpinato says Proposition 123 was a good example of how the governor wants to operate going forward, bringing together people affected by an issue and working out an agreement. He says in the next few weeks, the governor's office will be meeting with members of the education community about what's next.
Certainly, this is an issue that they care about, that's important to them, and we want to talk about how can we make sure that our schools have the resources moving forward to do their job, and that we're also seeing the results and the outcomes for our schools that parents want.
Scarpinato says the governor is committed to making sure schools can meet their capital needs, and that it'll be at the top of the agenda when Ducey's office meets with representatives of the education community.
It's the show for Thursday, May 26th. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. In 1945, toward the end of World War II, it was the beginning of what was to be an invasion of Japan, the arrival in and conquest of the island of Okinawa.
In American hands, Okinawa would mean the reduction of Japan from a powerful empire to an isolated land awaiting the shock of invasion.
The war ended, but the U.S. invasion never did, and now a U.S. president has landed in Japan.
As Prime Minister Abe indicated, we did discuss the tragedy that took place in Okinawa, and I extended my sincerest condolences and deepest regrets. And the United States will continue to cooperate fully with the investigation to ensure that justice is done under the Japanese legal system.
President Obama is not speaking of an incident from long ago. The president faced local protests and outrage over the rape and murder of a 20-year-old Japanese woman, allegedly by a U.S. military-based contractor in Okinawa, part of a pattern of crimes against the women of Okinawa that has raised tensions in U.S.-Japan relations for years. It's just one of the complications as the U.S. pushes to relocate a Marine base to the mainland of Japan. The latest incident has further heightened decades-long discontent with U.S. military facilities, particularly on the island of Okinawa. Okinawa is a hardship assignment for the U.S. military, but even that is putting it mildly. During the Vietnam era, Okinawa was a staging area for all kinds of weapons, including the toxic herbicide Agent Orange.
There was a habu on this side and a habu on this side where the barrels were, about 120 feet or something like that away from us. And we always wondered what the heck were those 55-gallon barrels with the orange ring around them.
It was mixed 50-50. I was instructed how to do it. I was told that it was Agent Orange. It was a herbicide. It would also help to keep the mosquitoes down.
U.S. veterans Ron Frazier and Joe Cipolla, who were featured in the documentary Defoliated Island, Agent Orange, Okinawa and the Vietnam War. It's based on reporting and research by John Mitchell, a British journalist based in Japan, who's author of the book Chasing Agent Orange on Okinawa. I spoke with Mitchell from Tokyo, where he says the wretched stewardship of Okinawa by the United States complicates all kinds of issues between the two nations, from efforts to get Japan to curtail its whaling fleet to changing its currency policies.
Ever since the end of World War II, which was 1945, the American military, they've been poisoning Okinawa's environment. Within a few years of the end of the war, over two dozen Okinawans were poisoned during an arsenic poisoning incident on one of the outlying islands. And ever since then, the military has been poisoning the land, the sea, and the air of Okinawa.
And is that because just of the functioning of the base, or is there something particular that's going on at Okinawa that is injurious to the environment?
More than anywhere else in Japan, probably, Okinawa has suffered from American weapons of mass destruction, especially during the Cold War, where we had the war in Korea and the war in Vietnam. The American military, they stockpiled chemical weapons in Okinawa. They put biological weapons there, they put nuclear weapons, and they stored Agent Orange. And since that time, there have been a number of accidents involving these chemicals. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, there were two leaks of nerve gas on Okinawa, which actually hospitalized more than 24 Americans. And then Agent Orange, of course, has been the main killer of people, both Americans and Okinawans in the island.
How would you compare the behavior and the environmental stewardship at Okinawa to similar kinds of concerns in other facilities around the world that the U.S. manages?
There's a lack of transparency when it comes to the American bases on Okinawa. In the United States, there's over 140 areas that have been listed by the EPA in need of dire cleaning. But overseas, the American military isn't responsible for checking the bases or for cleaning them up. So because of the Okinawan situation, where it's in a limbo, really, the American military doesn't need to come clean about contamination within its bases. So that means there's only a few ways open to people to find out how contaminated they are. First of all, you can interview whistleblowers for the military, you can use Freedom of Information Act, or you can test the land that's been returned by military bases. And all of those three methods, we found out that there's horrific contamination on Okinawa.
What's the cost, the potential challenge, if the United States were to aggressively clean this mess up on Okinawa and then just leave altogether?
Due to the variety of contaminants. We've got lead, asbestos, dioxin, we've got heavy metals, we've got pesticides. It's going to cost millions upon millions of dollars to clean up these bases. They're looking to return Futenma Air Station within the next few years. And if Futenma's ever returned to Okinawan civilian control, then it'll probably be billions of yen. And also it's probably going to take decades before it's cleaned up. And all of this contamination, it goes back to mainly the war in Vietnam. So during the Vietnam War, Okinawa served as the military's main launch pad for fighting in Vietnam. There was a famous quote by an American general, and he said that without Okinawa, we couldn't continue fighting the war in Vietnam. So everything for the military war machine, it was stored on Okinawan bases. Everything from toilet paper to beer to guard dogs. And also Agent Orange was stored there as well. And because Agent Orange was stored on Okinawa and also it was buried on Okinawa when it was surplus or when it was damaged, the potential costs and also the human health issue, it's unfathomable. Nobody can work it out yet.
And how would you say the environmental profile and this contamination issue has fared given the very, very difficult sort of human rights questions on Okinawa, where Okinawa personnel have actually interacted with the Japanese citizens, and there have been rape cases, and all of that is a very much a complicating factor between the U.S. and the Japanese.
It's a really good question. I think, first of all, the contamination issue, it shows that contamination, it doesn't know any fences. People within the bases and people outside the bases, they've been poisoned by these toxins. We've got American schools within Kadena Air Base that are located next to a dioxin dump site. And from my interviews, we've got over a dozen parents who say their children are sick from dioxin contamination. So to be honest, this issue, it unites both Americans and also Okinawans, because both of them have been equally affected by this. And I think it really shines a light on the Pentagon's hypocrisy as well, whereby the Okinawans, they see that the American military is not cleaning up this contamination. And also the American service members, they see that their own superior officers are denying this contamination as well. So actually it's become a way for both sides to kind of unite together in kind of an ironic and strange way. We've got over 250 American veterans who believe they're poisoned by Agent Orange on Okinawa. We've got Okinawan base workers who believe they were exposed, and also base workers who possibly died from dioxin exposure as well. And then we've got the civilian impact of dioxin poisoning on the island. In the late 1960s, there were 230 school children who suffered burns when they were swimming near a beach that had just been sprayed with Agent Orange on the east coast of Okinawa. So this is a problem that has affected people across generations. It's affected people on both sides of the wire. And the American military, they're denying all of this, just like they deny the effect of Agent Orange in Vietnam.
John Mitchell is a journalist and author of the book Chasing Agent Orange on Okinawa. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
In general, prosecutors have a reputation of being hard-nosed and unyielding when it comes to being tough on crime. But being a city prosecutor is much different than working at the county, state, or federal level. Vicki Hill has worked at the Phoenix Prosecutor's Office since 1994, and she recently became the city's top prosecutor. To learn more about what her office does, we met in her 8th-floor office downtown. And we started with talking about what makes her role different from what we may see in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office.
I think the difference is probably in the types of cases that we handle. We do misdemeanor prosecution, so any criminal misdemeanor that happens in the city of Phoenix will come through our office. One of the other reasons you may not hear much about me is I'm not an elected position, I'm an appointed position. That's probably a big difference.
And how often do those end up heading into trial before a judge, et cetera?
Probably the two most important, from a public safety standpoint, types of cases that we do are domestic violence and driving under the influence. We do about 5,000 domestic violence cases a year and about 4,000 DUI cases. And we do about 100 jury trials a year, and most of those are DUI.
Is there something about this particular realm in terms of, as opposed to corporate law, defense attorney, whatever it may be?
Really, my law school experience did that. I went to Creighton in Omaha, Nebraska. And when we sat down, you know, a lot of people talk about their law school experience being look to your left, look to your right, one of you won't be here. Our law school, when they did our orientation, they said, if you come out of law school in 3 years and all you have is a law degree, you haven't done very much. Get involved in your community. Keep your life intact. Don't forget your family. Have priorities. So when I went into law school and I started getting into the meat of the classes, the thing that spoke to me and allowed me to give back was public service.
Are you seeing anything in Phoenix that either excites you about the direction it's going or that, you know, maybe sounds a little alarm?
It's been fairly consistent over my time here that DUIs and domestic violence are probably our most serious caseload. I don't see any huge crime trends. What I see kind of from a national conversation is a desire to weed out or to address some low-level behavior in a more meaningful way, not just jail, and what's really nice about my office and my predecessors is we've had diversion programs since I started. Right now we have 8.
Vicki, how often do you find yourself in court these days?
You know, I don't go to court very much at all anymore. Most of my job is administrative, so it's a lot of meetings and policy. But I do get to weigh in on cases. So one of the really great things about our office is we encourage our attorneys to bounce things off each other, talk things over. What do you think about this? Is this off or too light? Is it too difficult? I had this happen in trial. Have you had this experience before? And so I am able to engage in case conversation, sometimes just as, you know, what do you think or what should we do? But going to court, I miss it. I really do, but I don't get to go down very much anymore.
Do you feel like in any way that, I mean, clearly you're happy with the job you have, that there are certain things that you hear about a case and you sort of think to yourself, boy, I'd love to sink my teeth into that one if I were an attorney doing something else?
That's a very timely question, because just last night I read the nominations for our various prosecutor categories for the Arizona Prosecuting Attorneys Advisory Council Summer Conference. And there were some very impactful cases about child abuse, horrific stories of things that were done to kids. And I thought, you know, if I won the lottery, I might just go and volunteer to do one or two of the, to learn how to do one or two of those cases, because I imagine their caseload is incredibly heavy and very intensive. And just to be able to take one or two of those off their plate and do something like that, I think that would be really rewarding.
Vicki Hill, who was recently named Phoenix City Prosecutor.
In the past 8 years, Valley Metro has brought light rail through central Phoenix and Tempe. It made its way into Mesa and now appears to be heading west. This week, the Glendale City Council laid the groundwork by agreeing on which route it will take. But as Casey Kuhn reports from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, not everyone is happy the rail is coming to town.
School's out and so is the sun. A perfect time for ice cream.
Want to try something new? You do?
In downtown Glendale, Linda Moran Whitley offers samples to young customers at her shop, Papa Ed's Ice Cream, a converted garage decorated to look like a New England cottage. It fits the theme in Catlin Court, where gas lamps and shade trees line the streets. And it's just north of the proposed light rail route coming through Glendale.
We have a lot to offer in historic downtown Glendale, and a lot of special events, and I think that the public transportation would help with some of the parking.
Moran Whitley was on the citizen committee that looked at all the proposed routes and said while she isn't against it, She wonders whether the final rail line will isolate her part of town.
The chosen route that was recommended could separate Catlin Court from historic downtown Glendale.
Glendale City Council just approved the route to the next stage of planning, where the city will study details and logistics, like how to cross I-17. The final route is this. It connects at 19th Avenue and Camelback, continues west and right before Grand Avenue, heads north on 43rd Avenue. To get downtown, the route follows west on Glendale Avenue and makes a jump to going west on Glen Drive, bisecting the city. The end point is still to be determined. Glendale Mayor Jerry Wires voted no on the route agreement at the meeting because he thought a streetcar option should have been considered.
I do not believe that it's fair for our residents or community business to sell them short of an opportunity simply because a long process has taken place and Valley Metro is remiss in providing all options.
In the hearing before the vote, locals and business owners seemed pretty evenly divided, for and against. Pete Gliniak owns Desert Rose Properties right off Grand Avenue, and he summed up the support like this.
We believe that light rail is the way of the future and is an additional tool to put downtown Glendale on the map.
But it's not just business owners who came to speak. Donna Chung is passionate about her constitutional rights. She's a Chinese immigrant who's now a citizen and does not take democracy for granted.
We are very disturbed by the Glen Drive Selection Committee, not because we are abrogating our citizens' duty, but because we were not informed.
She heads the Arizona chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League on Glen Drive, right in the light rail's path. She worries the construction would create safety and access problems for the senior citizens who make up the majority of the group. But Glendale can look east to see what might happen with the addition of the light rail. Here's Mesa Vice Mayor Dennis Kavanaugh, who's also a Valley Metro Rail Board member.
Glendale really is in a good position because of being able to learn from the experience that Phoenix, Tempe, and Mesa have had.
Kavanaugh says a few Mesa businesses did close during the process, but the results have been overwhelmingly positive. He suggests Glendale keep the community involved every step of the way.
You have a construction process. You need to make sure that there is really 24-hour assistance available if problems arise.
The light rail construction isn't slated to start until 2023. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Glendale.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name's Ron, and I'm here playing cornhole at the Hub Bar and Grill. They block off one row of parking right up against the fence and set up 2 to 3 sets of boards.
Here we go.
4-2. Ronnie.
My name's Jack Edlund.
Oh!
It's harder than it looks because the boards are 27 feet from front to front from each other and throwing a 1-pound bag towards the hole.
Oh, it hung in there.
It's pretty tricky. You got to get it on the board.
Sticky side.
If you're really good at it, you can block the hole, and then when it's your turn, you can hit your bag in and keep the hole blocked.
Ooh, dang. You just have a good time until it. You say, whoop, I'm out.
That's Jack Edlund and Ron Buselik playing cornhole at the Hub Bar and Grill in Mesa. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just would like to hit us gently with a beanbag, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
In KJZZ News, you've probably heard the term gender pay gap, which is defined as the hourly wage difference between men and women. Now, a research firm has released data showing a housing gender gap. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on the findings that reveal homeownership is more profitable for single men than single women.
RealtyTrack analyzed more than 2 million single-family homes and found the average market value of homes owned by single men was 10% higher than those owned by single women. In Arizona, the value gap was 7%. The analysis also showed single men in Arizona have gained 27% more in home value since purchase compared to single women. When it comes to safety and health, Arizona women fare better than men. RealtyTrack says single men are more likely to live in neighborhoods with a higher density of registered criminal offenders and higher environmental hazard risks, like poor air quality, brownfields, and former drug labs. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
4 decades ago, when television was dominated by only 3 networks, yes, Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu fans, there was such a time in ancient history. The miniseries Roots became one of the most watched programs in history. Starting on Monday, a group of cable networks, including the History Channel, is reviving Roots for a new generation. But it's a different production with a fresh group of actors. And with me to talk more about that is Matthew Delmont, Associate Professor of History at ASU. He's written a book about Roots that'll be published later in the summer. Matthew, millions of people were captivated by the original Roots. When you look back at it, do you understand why?
I think the series is fascinating still. I think what made it so impactful in the 1970s was that it was just at a moment coming out of the Civil Rights Movement that more Americans were starting to pay attention to African-American history. So you had some of these great works of African-American history starting to show up in universities in the 1960s and 70s. But for ordinary Americans who hadn't yet been exposed to that, Roots was really the first time they'd seen this depth of history presented on a national scale. So telling this family's story from slavery to freedom, reaching over 100 million Americans through television at just the moment before cable comes in and makes that kind of mass culture moment impossible. That's what I think is really powerful about the Roots story.
What sort of conversations were taking place then? Did people address the issues or did they look at it more as entertainment?
I think a mix of both. Roots tried to change the way Americans saw slavery and felt slavery. So I think there's something different about knowing that slavery existed or knowing that it existed for X number of years or that so many people were enslaved. Taking that history and linking it to specific people, to specific characters, and to a specific family's history was really powerful. And it forced people to deal with that history on a more kind of visceral, emotional level. I think that's what people took away from it. Some of those conversations, I think, ended up being a lot about guilt, about sort of these feelings of emotions. People would personalize it in many ways. But I still think having ordinary Americans talk about these things in homes and workplaces and bars and churches, that was different. You just didn't have – Americans generally don't like to talk about slavery. And to have this be an occasion when people can deal with this really difficult history was important.
So now there's a new miniseries which will be on History Channel and A&E. And will it be something that you think more serious conversations will come out of because it seems as though people are more aware of how terrible the situation actually was?
I think our discussions as a country about slavery kind of ebb and flow. So we're back in a moment now where we're paying more attention to it. And we see it in our popular culture. 12 Years a Slave, Django Unchained, Underground recently got a lot of attention on television. So I've had a chance to see the new series, and I think one of the pressures that they face is trying to make it entertaining for a contemporary audience while still having historical value, while not sort of over-exaggerating the type of violence that's there. I think there's a fine line of trying to represent something that's almost unrepresentable, the horrors of slavery, while also telling a narrative story that gets you to pay attention to the characters, that it's not just about having these black characters suffer, but it's about having them survive and having them live lives and create families and maintain that family bond over 100 plus years.
So as far as the more specific African-American audience, how big a legacy does Roots have in terms of whether it's African-Americans who want to find out more about their own history, whether it's wanting to get more involved in finding about their own story, even writing about their own story, keeping journals, whatever it may be? Is that legacy long-running? Is it still going at this point?
Absolutely. The legacy of Roots among African-American audiences was profound. The book people describe as being like a Bible that would be in the family home because it was a tome. It was 600 pages, right? It was just something that was, you have it on your coffee table, have it on your bookshelf, and it meant something to see that depth of research and depth of African-American history. The other thing is it was at a moment when genealogy used to be just about people who came from royal families or came from high esteem families. For both African Americans and for white ethnic people as well, Alex Haley's book came at a moment when that conversation shifts. Now people are interested in genealogy and ancestry, even if you come from working class folks or immigrants or formerly enslaved people. That's really powerful for African Americans. And we can see, I think the best through line is Henry Louis Gates' shows, the PBS genealogy shows he's done. He describes Alex Haley as being one of the influences for that. And I think Haley's book helped to introduce a cultural moment where, and people have always cared about their ancestors, but doing this in a more formal way, that you would do it as a hobby, you would do it as something you want to pass down these stories to families, that's something Haley's Roots had a lot to do with.
How important is it for us to be reminded of slavery from this sort of point of view? We have the stories of racial strife in many ways when it comes to relationships with police officers, whether it comes to the Confederate flag, whatever it may be. Is this still a good pathway for people to discuss the issue, having a fictional miniseries like this?
I think so. I think for two reasons. One, What was so important about Roots is that it foregrounded the experience of African-American characters in slavery. So just the year before Roots, broadcast in 77, Gone with the Wind aired. And that at the time was actually the most watched television show of all time in 1976. So people were still clinging to this idea of happy slaves and benevolent slave masters. Roots really flipped that, and it asked viewers across racial lines to identify with the black characters. That is still very powerful. We don't get asked to do that a lot in our contemporary media. And I think the generational story that Roots was telling was powerful and unusual. It makes it different than Underground or different than 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. The history of slavery and its legacies in the present are generational stories. That African Americans who are in the United States today, most of us have ancestors who were enslaved. And that's a story about roots and ancestry, but it's also a story about wealth transfer. Right? I think that those are the kind of stories that we need to be reminded of in discussing slavery. I think many of the racial issues we're dealing with today are the unresolved legacies of that. And I think Roots is a very small entry point, but it can be an entry point to those large and important conversations.
Matthew Delmont, Associate Professor at ASU. Matthew, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
State lawmakers proposed more than 1,300 bills during this year's legislative session, and at least a few of them bore more than a passing resemblance to measures in other states. The Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting looks into this concept of so-called model legislation in a new report released today. Evan Wyloch is the group's senior reporter, and he joins me. And Evan, it seems Arizona's lawmakers aren't always so unique with their bills.
Yeah, and this is nothing new, but what we were able to identify is at least a handful of bills that match to bills that have either been run in other states or were proposed this year also in other states.
And it seems like there's sort of a combination of where these bills come from. There are groups that put them out. There are just legislators looking at what their colleagues in other states are doing, things like that, right?
Yeah. So they come from a few different places, it seems. You've got kind of large think tanks like the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC. You've also got the National Council of State Legislatures, known as NCSL. And then you've got some smaller think tanks that lean either to the left or to the right. And then on top of that, you've got bills that maybe come from specific companies or from specific industry associations as well.
Were there certain topics that these bills dealt with that you found?
Well, what we were able to hone in on is that it seems that there are about four categories for these kinds of bills. You've got your highly technical sort of adjustments that create uniformity across states. Then you've also got kind of the pet project partisan stuff that comes from both the right and the left. You know, on the right, you've got stuff like using silver and gold for legal tender. On the left, you've got things like banning the sale of ivory in any given state. And then the last category is really just, you know, companies or industries looking to create regulations or laws that are going to positively affect their bottom line. So it's kind of like a fight over a buck.
Are any of these things that Congress normally would be taking up and dealing with on a national level as opposed to, for example, companies having to go to 50 individual states to try to get something passed?
Well, the short answer is yes. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that we would historically expect to see addressed in the U.S. Congress. But as you know, and most people who pay attention know, the Congress doesn't get a lot done these days. So a lot of people out there who are interested in affecting change have adjusted their calculation to target state legislatures as the place where they can actually get things done.
Without asking you to pass a judgment on this practice, I mean, what are some of the implications, both positive and negative, of this practice of having one state introduce a bill that is very similar or in some ways maybe exactly like something that's in another state?
Well, we talked to a lot of people for the story, and there were people who said, look, model legislation is a great way to go because we can identify where something works in a state and we can make a judgment on what we want. You know, do we want the same kinds of outcomes that they've got? And if so, let's take that piece of legislation. No use in trying to reinvent the wheel, and we can just enact it here as well. But on the flip side, it kind of indicates, you know, interest groups or lobbyists having greater influence over state legislatures. It's a departure from the idea that constituents are the drivers of the legislative agenda.
Do you think there's any reason to think that this trend will not continue into the foreseeable future?
Oh, I think we're definitely going to continue to see model legislation. You know, it wasn't invented just recently. It's been going on for a long time. If you talk to people that have been at the Capitol for, you know, a number of sessions, they'll tell you that they think it is on the increase. So maybe we'll see more and more of it. But this is really one of the first attempts to quantify how much of it is going on.
Evan Wyloge is a senior reporter at the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. We are talking about the report released today about model legislation in Arizona and across the country. Evan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Phoenix Union High School District has two schools they call small specialty schools. Those are Bioscience High School and Franklin Police and Fire High School.
And now it's adding a third, Phoenix Coding Academy. Construction finished earlier this year, and the first class of students will start in the fall. The show's Annika Klein looks into what's behind the doors.
It's a brand new building, cost about $12 million to construct. It sits in what used to be a parking lot for Central High School, near Indian School Road and Central Avenue, wedged between the auditorium and softball field. And in some ways, it's similar to its neighbor.
Here we have a traditional art room.
That's Seth Butte, Phoenix Coding Academy's principal. He shows me around. They have a library, a gym.
This is where students will eat lunch. We also have the floor set up for basketball, volleyball.
Upstairs, there are classrooms with desks, chairs, and printers.
Here we have two 3D printers that are going right now. We also have a milling machine, some drill press. We'll get laser engravers.
Each student also gets a laptop, and there's no textbook in sight. Butte says they're building an environment where students gain the skills they need to get tech-related jobs.
We had a lot of input from industry partners, community members, to get an idea of what kind of students are they looking for and what kind of skill sets are they looking for.
They're also paying attention to what's missing from the tech industry.
Silicon Valley, the home of the California tech industry, has long been criticized for its lack of diversity.
You may remember those headlines from last year. That's why Phoenix Coding Academy is also recruiting with diversity in mind.
Ideally, we would want the school to look like a microcosm of the city at large, the metro area.
Right now, they have 7 teachers, most of them women. And 80 kids from around the valley are enrolled in the first freshman class, with room for 120.
I know I have students from South Phoenix, West Phoenix, East Valley. I have a student coming from Northwest Peoria.
But despite a big push to attract girls, they only make up a third of the students so far. The teachers are meeting all summer to brainstorm ideas. In this meeting, robots are casually mentioned as a project idea. Teacher George Cardenas brought it up.
I love robots. I could talk about robots for hours. But, I mean, I see robots as just kind of a big culmination of engineering and programming and just everything, every subject matter around.
The staff admits that fun technology is like a carrot to dangle in front of students to engage them. But Seth Butte says these skills will have practical applications in growing fields. For example,
right now, Arizona's projected number one in IT-related jobs over the next 10 years.
So that begs the question, why build a new school rather than spread these resources to all schools in the district? Craig Plotenik is with Phoenix Union High School District and says that's actually the end goal.
We look at this as being a laboratory for creating some coding classes, some technology classes that maybe are new, and then spinning them out to the other districts.
So that in the future, many other students get to print their finals like this. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.